What have you done?
I filled completely out of character.
And this sort of daydream came to me that
it was in my blood.
Is there anything worse
what are you doing?
Than someone saying, oh, no. I thought about that a lot afterwards.
He says, I'm not leaving.
It's weird.
I'm staying.
And then by the light of an oil lamp.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Sally Patey lives in this very cool house. She has five giraffes grazing in her backyard. She goes to sleep at night with the pungent aroma of gorilla wafting through her windows and the sounds of a Sumatran tiger purring nearby. Sally's a very resourceful woman. Starting out with not much at all, Sally and her former husband built a zoo, Mogo Zoo, on the New South Wales south coast. They lugged steel and poured the cement for the enclosures. In the early days, they'd collect animals in borrowed vehicles. Sally has hand-reared cougars, lions, and pandas in her home. 24 years later, the zoo she built is a thriving subtropical home to more than 200 animals, and they run breeding programs as part of a worldwide effort to manage endangered species. Now, having built this beautiful place, Sally finds it impossible to leave. She's addicted to being in the presence of these exotic animals, and in fact, living near them is pretty much everything she wanted out of life. Hello, Sally. Welcome.
Hi, Richard.
You actually live at the zoo, don't you? Tell me the kind of things you hear at night as you're sort of drifting off to sleep.
Yes, I live right in the middle of the zoo, and it's amazing to lay there at night and listen to the lions roaring. And when they're all roaring, because we have them in three different parts of the zoo, one lot will start and then the next and then the next. And
how is that soothing? Is that soothing? Is it to your lions roaring?
You know, even after all these years, I never, ever, ever get sick of it. And every now and again, the Siamangs will start, and it's like having your own Pavarotti in the backyard. You know, it's mainly they call during the day, but when they call at night, they always call for about 20 minutes. So I always get up and sit on the veranda and I listen, and just it's amazing.
Can you smell your neighbours, smell the animals?
Yes, I can. Well, it's not a smell that's offensive. It's actually quite pleasant. But yeah, when you sit there and you on the veranda of an evening, you can sort of just smell the wafting of the gorillas coming out, because my bedroom's actually not far from where theirs is. So when we first built that exhibit, we built it for chimps, and the first night I heard them, I just went, uh-oh. Big mistake building it there. But yeah, the chimps were quite noisy, but the gorillas no, they're very subtle.
I've spoken to people who've taken care of gorillas in the past in Africa, and they say they actually smell quite nice, actually. It's not,
yeah.
It's, how would you, is there any way you can describe it? I mean, I don't know what on earth you compare the smell of gorilla to, but how would you describe it?
Well, when I was standing outside at 11:30 the other night, against my fence, which was probably 5 metres from where they were, you could really smell, it's like a musky sort of odour.
And do they make noises at night as well, or do they just
go
to sleep?
No, not really. Every now and again you'll hear a little bit of a noise come out, but I think it's just a little bit of a grunt as one moves from one, turns over maybe. But no, they're quite quiet, actually.
You have a Sumatran tiger called Quinoa, boarding, if that's the word for it, just behind you there. Tell me his story, the story of Quinoa.
Quinoa was born with a problem, and it wasn't until he was a few weeks old we realised that there was a problem. So I decided to keep him, and we started doing x-rays, and it was actually when he was 6 months old we were able to really determine what the problem was, and he was born without a socket joint and the ball, and it had actually fused. So we didn't really know whether he was going to be able to, once he grew up and he started to put weight on and to get to a full-size tiger, whether he would actually be able to bear weight and everything. But here he is. He'll be 5 this year on the 9th of June, and he's going excessively well, and he's just the most beautiful tiger. He's not actually on display in the zoo, and when we sort of realised, yes, he's going to make it, I sort of went, well, I've got to build something for him. So I turned my backyard into his playpen.
His playpen. Now, when I had a previous guest on, I asked him a slightly silly question, which is, can you actually have a big cat as a kind of a pet? And he said, can you domesticate them? And he said, well, sure you can, I suppose, but think of what your own cat's like and what happens when they get a bit nippy. Mm. Now, imagine that as a vast, hugely powerful animal. What happens when Quinoa gets a bit nippy when you want to roll around and play with him?
Well, that's what you've always got to recognise, is that they are a wild animal, and growing up, he we always treat them as a wild animal. And it's all very well to say that we're going to domesticate them and things like that, but it's you've got to have that respect for them. And he grew up knowing, I grow them up knowing that they're going to end up in an exhibit, so that when that time does come, it's not a shock to them and they think, oh, why, I should be still sitting out there on the lounge or on the table after dinner or something like that. So he was quite happy, and he grew up with our German Shepherd. And
is he friends with the German Shepherd?
Oh, they love each other. It's quite amazing. It is quite amazing.
I've seen footage of you kind of like rolling around and cuddling Quinoa the tiger.
When he was little. When he was little, yes. But what they learn when they're little, they do when they grow up. And I know a lot of people still do work with them as they get older, but we don't know.
How can you tell when he's happy?
Oh, when they chuffle.
What does that mean?
Oh, that's he's a very chuffly tiger.
What does it mean? What is chuffling? What is that?
It's a noise they make. It's sort of like they go, you know, it's... Probably some people can chuffle better than me, but he always relates to it.
Is that like they're purring, is it, or does he purr as well?
No, they don't purr. They're not like lions. That lions roar, you know. I mean, that's just the most guttural, amazing sound. Tigers do roar, but in a different sort of way, but they also chuffle. Snow leopards chuffle too. That's an amazing sound as well.
Why are you so focused on tigers in particular at the zoo? Their population levels are so...
Well, we have...
Such a danger species, aren't they?
We have 9, 10, 11 tigers at Mogo Zoo. Some of them aren't on display. I've got two very old ones that I brought home recently to live their life out. And they lived sort of down the back where with Quinoa. And
you take retired tigers? Is that the word for them, or older tigers? Where have they been before they've been to come with you?
One of them was with me, Thelma and Louise. I had two tigers called Thelma and Louise because when they came to us many, many years ago, they never had names, and I'd just watched that movie, Thelma and Louise, and I walked past one day and they were having a bit of a spat, and I said, come on, you two. I said, you're just like Thelma and Louise, and it stuck. Yes.
Now, I mentioned that there is a breeding program at your zoo for tigers.
Yes, there
tigers.
Is.
Mm-hmm. How does that work with tigers in particular?
Well, it's all controlled by a stud book keeper within Australia, and there's also a global program. And we've got some young tigers at home at them. Oh, they're just coming up three now, but they were part of the breeding. They're part of the Sumatran program, and you get recommendations of which female to breed with which male and that. So, yeah, we're part of the Sumatran breeding program. I mean, the whole idea of zoos today and the whole role of zoos today has changed, and we're trying to save these animals. And will they go back into the wild? I don't think in my lifetime. But when we started the zoo, the whole aim was, if we're going to build a zoo and we're going to have animals behind wire, they need to be animals that are going to benefit from being there. And that is what I've set out to do.
He grew up in New Zealand. Was it into a big family?
Mum and Dad. I've got an older sister, Michelle, who's just truly amazing, and she's been amazing, you know, right through this whole thing, and my brother, Dean. Yeah, so we all live in Australia, and my dad actually lives here now with me too.
You were actually born with the name, not the name Sally. What name did your parents give you?
My name is Simon.
It's very French.
Yeah, it's very French. Yeah.
And you'd change it to Sally later on.
A long story, husbands. Bill, we decided. Plus, when I came to Australia, everyone in Australia says Simone, and I didn't like being called Simone. So, yeah, I don't know how it ended up with Sally, but... my real name is Simon.
How did you become besotted with animals? Was this through family pets when you were a kid?
I've always been totally animal orientated. I was the only one in the family. My dad is very animal orientated. My mum wasn't.
That mattered, that your mum didn't like animals much?
Oh, yes, because I was always bringing home every stray cat and dog and all sorts of things. And she gave one of them away one day, and I can remember. It was only a couple of years ago when, just before she passed away, we were talking, and she said, do you remember when you were younger and you told me that one day you were going to have so many animals and you would never, ever be able to get rid of them, Mum? And yeah, and I did, and I just went, wow, you know, look at that, and look what I've got now.
You were a horsey girl, weren't you, as a kid? Was riding an obsession for you, or just an everyday part of life?
Oh, an obsession. Oh, yes. I was your typical girl that would ride 4 kilometres after school every day on their bike just so that they could see their pony.
Did you have any idea on of what your future life might be? Did you have a kind of a sense that, oh, one day I'll grow up and run a zoo?
No, I didn't. I wanted to ride in the Olympics. That was my dream when I was a child.
Tell me about the job, your first job that you had when you left home at 15.
I went to Auckland with my horse called Slippery. Because he used to be able to slip in and out of anything. He was, yes. And, yes, I worked for a chap up in Auckland to gain experience in riding because, as I said, I always wanted to become an Olympian rider.
And what was the job itself?
Working with horses. It was a big wake-up call.
In what way?
Things aren't quite what they seem sometimes. You go and work somewhere like that and you're not treated sometimes the best, and you work very hard and you learn a lot of life lessons, and I certainly did. And you work very hard, and sometimes when you're 15 and you've just left home and you end up, it's made me realise as life goes on, how I like to treat people as I would like to be treated.
Mm. How were you treated in that?
Not very nicely.
In what way?
Well, you come in at night and you don't know, you live a long way from home and there's not a lot of food there for you to eat. And
what, not enough food to eat?
No. And you think, I lasted quite some time, and my father, when I finally rang him and I said, Dad, this is what's going on, he had a truck there within 2 days to pick my horse and I up. And he picked us up and we went home.
What was the last straw for you there?
I suppose, what was the last straw? I suppose getting pounced on by a horse after somebody did something not very nice to it.
Pounced on?
Yeah. Had my head split open.
Did you quit riding after that?
No. Oh, no. Oh, gosh, no. I've always loved horses, but when I came to Australia, I sort of gave up my riding.
So what was your plan when you came to Australia, Sally?
I came to Australia because I wanted to be a woman. I always wanted to be a policewoman, and then I wanted to become a detective. Yeah. So I couldn't become one in New Zealand because I was too short. I'm only 5'2".
So how did you meet Bill, who was later to become your husband?
Well, I came to Australia and I expected to see kangaroos hopping everywhere, and it wasn't quite like that. I went into Melbourne and I got a job because, I mean, you work, you don't, you know, that was my ethics. You've got to find a job and you've got to work. So I found a job and it was door-to-door selling, and I lasted 2 weeks. Most people only lasted a few days. So I ended up leaving and I was going to go back to New Zealand, and a friend of mine's, of my cousin, said to me, listen, I'm going up to Batemans Bay for Christmas to spend Christmas with my mum and dad. Would you like to come with me and see a little bit of Australia, a little bit more before you go home to New Zealand? And I went, wow, that would be so neat, you know. And I did, and I met Bill. 6'2", tall, handsome, tattooed ex-bikey, who I instantly fell madly in love with, and I thought my parents are going to have a fit, but he turned out to be the most amazing man.
What were the circumstances he was living in at the time? Was it difficult for you to get together at that point? Was he with someone else at the time?
Yes, he was, and I didn't. Being as a young, naive Kiwi girl, I didn't realise a few things, and when I did, I ended up going back to New Zealand, and within about 3 months, the phone rang at 1 o'clock in the morning and it was Bill. He said, when are you coming back? And within 4 days, I was back here. So he picked me up at the airport, and it was just, I don't know, I just used to live in the minute then, I suppose. We travelled around Australia for quite a few years, and I learnt some amazing things off Bill, you know. And our life was just togetherness, you know.
So what happened when you got pregnant? You were travelling around Australia. That obviously made a change of plans, didn't it?
Oh, it did, yes. So I got pregnant, and so we decided to go back to New Zealand to live. And so we went back to New Zealand when I was 7 months pregnant. but Bill didn't like New Zealand. We sold up everything and we took our car with us, and when we decided to come home, Casey was 3 months old. Mum and Dad were pretty devastated, but Bill wasn't happy in New Zealand. He didn't like it. So we arrived back in New Zealand in November of 1983 with $960 to our name. That was it.
How did you take to being a mum?
In the beginning, when I was first pregnant and right through my pregnancy, I did not have a maternal instinct in my body, to be honest. And one of the nurses that talked to me, she said, don't worry about it. She said, don't worry. She said, some people from the minute they're pregnant are maternal. But she said, how do you know until you actually have the baby?
Well, that's right, because the baby's just this silhouette.
Yes.
And with an X in the middle.
And it was quite terrifying, you know, having this, you know, moving.
I know, and I'm going to meet this new stranger who I don't know at all.
Yes, and I'll never forget the minute she was born and they showed her to me. And it was just like this overwhelming feeling of protection and a feeling that only mothers for the first time will have, you know. And you feel so protective, and it was in that split second that I went, from the minute they are born until the day you die, they're part of your life and part of your inner being, yes.
You know, as a man, as a father, you know, when you watch that happen, that's amazing to see it happen too. This kind of, you see this flood, and when it does happen, it doesn't happen all the time, unfortunately. Mm. But of course, when it does happen, it's an amazing thing to observe this change. You know, the woman will be saying, oh, I don't know if I'm cut out to be a mother. And then it's like, don't touch my baby.
I know. I just didn't want anybody to touch her. You know, like it was like, I didn't even want Bill to hold her. You know, it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, this baby. And of course, he was a seasoned dad. He knew exactly what to do. I didn't. Yeah.
So you were back in Australia and you'd bought a house, and then Bill had an accident that laid him up for a while. How did that happen?
Oh, a buffalo stuck its horn through his foot and split his foot in half.
Right. You don't see that coming, do you?
You don't, no. But,
why were you there? Why were you in the presence of a buffalo?
Well, we'd always had this thought. I mean, we never, ever dreamt that we'd ever have the money or to be able to have a zoo. You know, so we were going to have a taxidermy museum, and Bill had learnt taxidermy when we were in New Zealand off a guy called John McCosh. And so we decided that we would have a taxidermy museum because we couldn't have them like this. Even though we were never hunters, we used to do a lot of pig hunting. We had dogs and all that sort of stuff, you know, which some people might be a bit surprised about me running through the bush in a pair of boots and shorts and knife strapped on the side, but that's when you're younger.
That is. But taxidermy is a really fascinating thing. I find it really fascinating. Yeah. It's so painstaking and careful and strange at the same time as well.
Well, Bill used to do all the mounting and the finishing off of everything and making the moulds and all that sort of stuff, and I'd do all the skinning and the fleshing and all that sort of thing. After I did 50 fox skins once, I just went, I will never, ever look at another one ever again.
So that's why you went to see a buffalo, was it?
Well, we got told about a buffalo that they couldn't. It was running amok and they couldn't get it. I mean, this is going back, you've got to remember, 24, 25 years ago. So they said that they had to put it down, and would we like it for our museum one day, because one of the chaps knew us. So after work on a Friday afternoon, we jumped in the car and drove 11 hours, which was pretty tiring. And, it's the old saying, carpe diem, he who hesitates is lost. You should always go with your first thoughts, and Bill let someone else influence him, and he was the one that, he got the horn went through his foot.
So how did that accident affect your family?
I had to drive all the way home with a two-year-old. Oh, they'd given us a buffalo calf too.
A buffalo calf.
Oh, yes.
You had a buffalo calf in the car.
And a pet lamb. Yeah.
And a two-year-old.
Bill had said to me the afternoon beforehand, he said, we're going home. He said, I want to get back to his doctor, Dave Rivette.
To treat his foot.
Yeah.
But before you get there, I do have to ask, how do you get a baby buffalo and a lamb and a two-year-old into a car?
With great difficulty.
Did you have to have a cage or something for the buffalo?
Oh, well, I had to build something on the back of the trailer. We'd taken a trailer with us. So I got given an old playpen and a baby's playpen. So I made this pen on the back of this trailer and put a tarp over it and everything and put the straps around, you know, the snatch straps and everything. And then I suddenly went, oh, no, I haven't left a door. So I had then put the back of the trailer down and we were able to pop the calf up underneath there because it was only little because we'd always wanted a buffalo. And, yeah, so and the lamb sat on the seat next to Casey in a box and Bill sat there with his leg up in the air and we drove home.
So you bought a property on the New South Wales south coast. Were you entertaining thoughts of a zoo at all at that time when you bought
yes.
the property?
Oh, yes. Well, the taxidermy museum and maybe a few animals. We bought the property in partnership with a friend of ours who was a doctor.
And what was the property like when you first set eyes on it?
Well, there's a very old house. Probably should have been bulldozed, but we didn't. We couldn't afford to do that. There was a shell of a shed, a concrete floor, and a lot of rubbish. So we set about, yeah, we got the house livable. And, yeah, we started to build our museum. Then I went to Canberra to pick up an antelope head. Someone had lost one, and we went up and picked it up so that we could put it in the museum. And I saw some animals, and I just went, oh, my gosh.
What kind of animals are we talking about?
I saw some African servals.
Oh, they're beautiful creatures, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing. And they look really odd, too. They're like, they've like got a cat's head, but on a kind of a cougar's body or something. I don't know.
No, they've got very long legs.
Yes.
They sort of look like a small cheetah, and they're an African cat. And I'd never, ever in my life seen anything so beautiful. It was, and I just could not believe where we went and they had these animals. So on the way home, the lady I was with, she said that she'd read this article about zoos and this new board that had been formed. So when we got home, we got the book and I started ringing them and I said, I want to start a zoo. And they said, no. So about
what made you think that was even possible? If someone said to me, I'm going to start a zoo, you'd go, you just think to yourself, I don't know, that's not going to happen. So, wouldn't you? What made you think you could do it?
Well, someone said to me once, how did you do it? And I said, well, to tell you the truth, I don't know. Because how do you explain that you just, it's like you've got blinkers on and when someone says no, it's like, I can't not do this, you know. And because I'd seen lots of really not good things, I wanted to be able to do it and do it so well, you know, and do it better. And even though we didn't have any money, I mean, we started with $4,000 and a dream, you know.
Do you think that naivety was a help? So I don't think anyone would do anything if they had all the information on what would be required to do it, would they?
No, I don't think so. It was just, no, I don't think so. I just was, I suppose, dogmatic about. So I'd ring up 3 times a week, you know, and they'd say, nope, can't do it. And so next week I'd ring up and I'd say, but I've come up with this new idea. What do you think of this? And they'd go, nope, you can't do it. And in the end, they sent me the papers. And years later, I said to them, did you send me that paperwork just to get rid of me? And they said, yep, because they were so sick of me ringing up, you know.
Did you have any idea of how zoos were run?
No. We went to Taronga and did work experience. I went up there a couple of different times and Bill went up there. So, and they said we were the first ones that had ever, you know, wanted to start a zoo that had actually come before they'd applied for a licence. But the thing is, we needed to know about what we were doing. And I mean, I'd always been animal orientated and so was Bill, you know. So, yeah, you don't think that someone says, no, you can't do it, go and sit over there. You just think, okay, what's another way around it, you know.
So what did you learn in a week's worth of work experience at Taronga Park Zoo?
That spider monkeys really, really love to pull you long plait, because I had very long hair at the time, and smack you on the bottom. No, that's just a Frankie. Some of the girls at Taronga will still remember that. But no, I learned some amazing things, you know, and saw some very dedicated people and decided, yes, this is what
you were more motivated to start a zoo.
I was more motivated,
after your week, you weren't discouraged at all.
No, and going into the big cat area to hear that noise for the very first time, the sound of those big cats when they walked along there, they would pretty well hammer the doors, and it was like, oh my gosh, you have that sheer realization of this. When you see something that wants to kill you, you think, oh my gosh.
So you got your zoo license eventually, which couldn't have been easy. How did you persuade them you were absolutely serious and to give you a license, Sally?
Well, we applied and we just kept we weren't going to go away. So they kept saying to us, do native animals. And at the time, there was a lot of native parks around, and we saw a very special need for endangered exotic species. So that's why we just kept slogging after. I think it took us nearly 2 years to get the license. And then they gave us an 18-month, we were only allowed to get some crab-eating macaque monkeys, some African servals, and two very aged cougars from Taronga Zoo.
How about the construction process of it? You were heavily involved in that, both you and Bill, weren't you?
Yes, Bill built everything, and I helped as well. Got photos of me up ladders. I suppose that's why I had to have back surgery a couple of months ago, because I'm 5'2", he's 6'2", and I would work very hard alongside him as well. Then our nephew David came into it with us. So in those early days, I learnt an awful lot to help me in later years now in building and construction. I know sort of a lot about steel and sizes and how to build things, and I'm pretty handy like that. And when they put an 18-month time frame on us, it was like, oh my gosh, 18 months. We can't have anything more in 18 months. But I learnt a big thing then, because it takes time. Everything takes time. Everything takes money. And 18 months, it took us those 18 months to be able to get to that point, because you've got to build, you've got to come up with the money. It's not easy. I mean, even 24 years later, I now have to really think about, you know, how are we going to do it? You've got to think of the money and how are you going to get there?
Given that it was servals, those African cats that inspired you in the first place, how exciting was it to see your first servals arrive?
Oh, amazing. The 16th of December was when we got our first animals. That was three African servals. I still remember that day. It was so amazing. We went to, we had a very old truck at the time, and we drove up to Sydney in this old truck and picked them up. And it needed painting, so we only had orange paint. So Bill painted it orange, which was a little bit embarrassing, but driving around in an orange truck, but it looked better than it did before that. He was very good at making do and doing things up.
How about picking up your crab-eating macaque monkeys? What was involved in that?
Well, we didn't actually have a car at the time, because to finish their exhibit off, I went into town and sold the car. It was worth about $11,000, and they gave me a cheque for $5,500. And I said, but it's worth a lot more than that. And they said, well, that's all we can give you. So I took the cheque and walked out the front, and I had to hitchhike home because I didn't have any way of getting home. And I'm standing there in tears because I was trying to put my finger out, because I'd never hitchhiked in my life, and I was trying to think, how am I going to do this? And a friend came along and said to me, what are you doing standing on the side of the road there crying? And I said, I need to get home. So she took me home, and a friend lent us their car and trailer because they needed a lounge picked up in Sydney. I mean, this you've got to think, this is over 20 years ago now. So we went up and we picked their lounge up because the people wouldn't send it down. So we arrived there at some ungodly hour of the morning and picked it up and then went on and picked our monkeys up. And
so you went to pick up a couch and a bunch of crab-eating macaques at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what was it like driving through central Sydney with a trailer load of crab-eating macaques in the back?
We were driving through Newtown. I mean, it's little things in your life, well, in my life, stick. And we were driving through Newtown, and I was looking out the window at the shops going past, and I went, oh my gosh, look at that. I can see a monkey. And it was like, that's mine. You know, we're going home, and I looked at Bill, and he looked so tired, even though we were still just sort of going home through Newtown. I went, I must be the luckiest girl in the whole wide world. He must love me so much to be doing all of this. You know, this is thoughts, you know, to be doing this. We're doing this, you know, this amazing thing.
How did you learn how to care for the exotic animals that you had?
Well, I always thought I never had any common sense. I really did, all my life. But I realise now that I do. And to me, like, some people have got to learn things, and I will always learn. And if I don't know, I'll always ring someone and ask. The person I always used to ring was a lady called Bev. And she was from Melbourne Zoo. And if I thought if I needed to know something, I'd ring Bev and I'd ask her, you know. And I will always ask if I don't know. But to me, there's no difference between an elephant and a mouse. It's just you go about it in different ways. They're all animals. They all need to be looked after. And that's just my philosophy.
It might be a really dumb question, but with crab-eating macaques, do you actually feed them crabs?
We used to, yeah.
How do you feed them that?
Well, I used to go to the beach.
Really?
Yeah. You pick up crabs from the beach? They used to love to dive off this platform into the small pool that we had, and they were so amazing, and I'd read about them, you know, having the crabs. So, yeah, I used to go down to the beach and get crabs for them. Mm.
Running a zoo has to be a very expensive business. How tight did it get financially in the early days?
Very, very tight. It was never easy. It was always very much hand to mouth. I can remember getting given 12 bags of carrots once that were just on the turn, and I topped and tailed and peeled and salvaged about 2 or 3 bags of carrots out of them, and because I'd make do, I'd never waste anything, you know. And I vowed and declared, one day when I'm rich, I am never ever eating another carrot again as long as I lived. We ate carrots, the animals ate carrots, we had baked carrots, we had carrot soup, we had everything that you could think of. I cut them into different shapes, I you know, all sorts of stuff. But and I love carrots today, you know, just little things like that. It's just like Casey, you know, growing up in the zoo. She was never allowed to take a grape, you know, because I'd have it exactly how many grapes the animals needed. You know?
Oh, it's so, like that. It really did come down to that.
Oh, yeah. But you know something? It's never been about the money with me. And it still isn't today. I won't do something just for the money. The animals are very important. My staff. I have an amazing staff of 40 people. The gardens. I like to look at it as a whole big thing.
Tell me about the snow leopard you brought in from Denmark.
Mm-hmm. Well, when he came here, he was like the boy from the local parish, and she was like the girl from the other side of the tracks. And boy, could she give him curry. Took us quite some time to get them together, but it was all part of it's part of the global breeding program, and he was brought in as part of the program, but...
And have they...
Yeah, they have done it.
They have?
I mean, yes, they have.
I was wondering because it seemed like a strangely vulgar question as soon as I started to come out of my mouth, but have your leopards had sex?
Well, they have, but it's like I said, it's taken us an awful long time to get them together, but we have them together all the time now, and they're amazing. She hasn't as yet got pregnant. Over the years, I met the most amazing lady called Tenzin Palmo one night late at the zoo, one afternoon in the pouring rain, and I just had this most amazing experience with this lady, and she came to my zoo, and this is many years ago, and I said, would she like a cup of tea before she went? And she said she would, and so I made her a cup of tea, and she tried to pay for it, and I said, no. I said, sit down and talk a bit while you drink your tea. And I asked her, I hope you don't think I'm being rude, but why are you both dressed like that? They had long orange robes on, and so she told me her story. And after that, we had baby snow leopards.
What do you mean?
I don't know. Just this amazing thing happened, and our snow leopard got pregnant. And then the second time she came too. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, it was...
What did she do?
She just was so inspired when she saw them. She said she lived in a cave for many, many years in the Himalayas, and she never, ever saw a snow leopard. And so she wanted to see what one actually looked like. She'd seen lots of paw prints outside her cave, but she'd never actually seen one. And she came back a second time, and we had a second litter. I don't know where she is at the moment, but Tenzin, if you're listening to this...
You're welcome anytime at Mogo Zoo.
Well, the female we've got at home, we named after Tenzin. Her name is Tenzin. And Ilian, of course, Ilian's from overseas, and he's part of the program, yes. They both are.
And what happens when you breed an animal successfully? Do they then go to other zoos elsewhere in the world?
Well, when we breed, they're bred for these genetics and these genetics, and then they will be matched up somewhere else around the world or around the country here. Like we've got 4 cotton-top tamarins going to Taronga as an educational animals. We've got these 4 young males, and they're pretty cool. They have a big fig tree in their enclosure. And I said to the keepers as we were walking past one day, are they eating those figs? And they said, no, they don't seem to eat the figs. So that later on that day I went in, I thought, because I saw this one fig that looked really good. I love figs. So I went in and I picked the fig off the tree and stood there and I broke it in half. And the next thing, I had one on my shoulder pulling at my hand for this fig and the other one biting at the other side of it while I was biting into this delicious fig. So we sat there and they wouldn't take them off the tree, but as soon as I broke them open, they, it's just this, I mean, it's experiences like that, that how do you tell someone how that feels?
So every day then, or just about every day, your life is made up of a whole lots of little experiences that the rest of us don't have. Is that it?
It is, you know, like it's before hours and after hours too, is when it's an amazing place. You can walk around when there's no one there and you call out to the giraffes, you know, and I go, "Ijuma," you know, and he head turns around and he recognises my voice, you know, and that's a pretty amazing thing. And yes, I'm very lucky in that respect. But then there's the other side of it too. You know, I've got to run the zoo, and even though I have an amazing staff, you've still got the financial burden on it. It takes an awful lot to run a zoo.
So what is it you feel then for the animals in your care? Is it more a sense of love or responsibility for them?
It's a sense, I mean, love is a term, and Bill said this many years ago when someone said, "Oh, you don't love, you never say love," but love is an expression of how you feel. And yes, you do love the animals, but at the same time, you have to have huge respect for them and for why they're there and for how they live. You know, my philosophy is, I know a lot of people don't like to have animals in captivity, but we have them in captivity, and it's not that the fact that they're there, it's the quality of the life that you give them within that space that they have. And we're very big on enrichment and providing what, as best we can, what the animals need in a very professional sense. I've got my own vet now. She's been with us for 3 years. And, I mean, just the other day, she was on her first day off for a long time because of the Christmas holidays, and a black snake, first time it's ever happened, got into the meerkat exhibit. Big mistake on the black snake's part.
Why? What did they do to it?
Oh, it was like it had been run through one of those, you know, things that make the pasta, you know?
Right, yeah. What, it just was cut up to pieces, was it?
Well, it had holes all the way along it.
Wow.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it bit one of them. And within minutes, we knew. So I was straight on the phone. Sam was there. I'd say within 7 to 10 minutes of that happening, Sam was there, Sam and Paul.
Was she able to save the meerkat?
Yes, we did. We've saved him.
From the bite of a black snake?
Yeah. And he's the real little terrorist in the group too. I just knew it would have to be him. Yes.
Of course, your daughter was brought up within the zoo. Did she ever have any close calls with the animals that were about the place?
Yeah. I had a young cougar named Tom Cougar. He was the first cat I ever reared, and, of course, he was in the house, and I used to have him with access to the house. He was only a few months old, and I just got busy this day, and next thing I heard the scream coming out of the house, and I would always meet Casey off the bus, and I looked at my watch and went, "Oh no." And he was in the house, and of course, when he heard the door open, he must have hidden. So he let her walk all the way through the house to the kitchen, and then he pounced. So of course, I get into the kitchen, which was all pulled apart at the time because we were doing up the old house, and here she is standing on the freezer, arms and legs spread, screaming, and he's going, "Play with me, play with me." You know, And when you're only about 8 and you've got a cougar wanting to play with you, it's a little bit daunting.
Like I said, you've hand-raised a lot of these cats. Mm. And how long can you have them with you before they have to go into an enclosure?
Well, I've learnt a lot of things over the years, you know, and you learn as they're growing up. I've got an exhibit at the back of my house. And, I mean, of course, we don't hand-rear unless there's a problem. It's always so much better to let mum rear anything. So, but if there ever has been a problem, I will raise them. But they also go into the exhibit for parts of the day and things like that. So they learn as they're going along, to the point where once they go in, like I mentioned before, they're quite at home and they realise that they're a cat that lives in an exhibit, not on your backyard.
When's it time to get them out of the house if they are in the house?
Oh, only for the first few months. Seriously, I think of some people that have lions at 2 living in their house, and I go,
what do they do after that? They start chewing on the furniture?
From about 3 months. 2 to 3 months. You should see some of the chairs, yes.
I'm with Sally Patey, a woman who started her own zoo, Mogo Zoo, on the south coast of New South Wales. Jamila, the white lion. You hand-raised her, didn't you?
Jamila was a tawny lion, yes. And I hand-reared her and
And one Tuesday you got an awful message. Just tell me how that day unfolded, Sally.
I was upstairs and I heard a call come over the radio, and I quickly turned my radio up and I said, what's the problem? And then I realised what had happened. I ran down the stairs and I ran to where I knew she was. Things are just going whizzing through your head at this stage. You know, what on earth? What's happened, you know?
She'd gotten out.
She'd gotten out.
How had she gotten out?
Was an error with a gate. And first time and the last time, hopefully, touch wood.
And were there people, were there visitors in the zoo out and about at the time?
It was about 22 minutes past nine and we'd had a very early bus load of senior people in the zoo.
So you had a lion out and about in the zoo with people there?
I knew which area she was into and where she was heading for. And Jamila being Jamila, I used to always call her my 464 because she was a big block, you know, she was a big girl. And so I took my dog back, locked him in the office and ran, and that gave me enough time to come to my senses that if I ran to her and she got me down on the ground because she might get playful and knock me over, which would be very easy, then who would get hurt trying to save me? I mean, all these things, when you've got to think in a split second and make a decision, I've never had to do that before in my life. I've never had to think with my head instead of my heart in a split second. So I then thought of the gate. I ran for the gates, but I got the radio call. The front gates were shut. Someone asked me afterwards, why did you come public on it? And I said, well, the last person in was the husband of the editor of the Bay Post, apparently, and they asked me, they rang, and I said, yes, it had happened. So that day, my life changed forever. When you've got to order the death of an animal that you've hand-raised, but when you look at you've got a human life and the life of an animal, when you've got to make that decision, it's very hard.
Why couldn't have a tranquilizer dart been used?
A lot of people said that. Now, you've got to realise that, okay, the vet had been deployed. I didn't have an on-site vet then. We do now. But even still, when you plan to anaesthetise an animal, it's usually you've usually got half an hour to plan it, or if it's an emergency, or you have it planned for a week, right, this is what we're going to be doing on this day. When you dart an animal, it takes, 8 to 10 minutes for that dart to work. If in that situation that dart even fires properly, if something goes wrong, you've usually got them in a confined area, that animal is going to freak, and where is it going to end up within 8 to 10 minutes? There'll be somebody out there that'll remember saying in an email to me, 8 to 10 minutes, so what? Well, people should really think about sometimes before they make comments, you know, walk a mile in my shoes. I mean, that day, my animals have always come first, but that day was the hard. I don't ever want that to happen again in my entire life.
So all these calculations were whizzing through your head.
Yes, and then I dispatched the, my staff were fantastic. Our whole escape and recapture plan worked to thing. They said, we have her in our sights. And I said straight away, take the shot. And then the staff came on, please, Sally, just pleading with me, please don't do this. Let us try something. And then I heard a noise after the third time when I heard, we've got the shot. Maybe I'm being a bit too honest here. I don't know. And I heard a noise and I turned around and three gentlemen on walking sticks walked around and I knew that possibly we didn't have everybody in safety. And I just said, take the shot. And the minute that bang, as you can see, it's the minute that bang, I ran to her because I knew where she was. It's still very raw after all these years, but, you know, some people said some terrible things, you know. But for every bad thing, there would have been hundreds of good things said. People were so good to me. Carol that worked for me, we always called her our Baba Yaga. She is just the most amazing lady. She said to me, Sally, she said, I've learned a new language today. It was pretty bad what some people said, but then on the other hand, I got so much support too, because when a lot of people, if you ask how can you make a decision like that, does that make sense?
It does. How hands-on are you at the zoo today, Sally?
Well, I've never been an office person. I was always an animal person, and I like to be outside all the time, but over the years I've had to come into the office. And how hard is that for somebody that really doesn't know how to do things? A few years ago we had some big problems with someone, and I had to learn everything. It was a big wake-up call, you know. So even today I still do all the money side of things because I have to.
Has anyone ever offered to buy it from you?
Yes.
And what happens then? What do you think? Why have you not sold it?
Because by the time I take the lions, because I couldn't sleep without the lions roaring at night, and then I'd
need lions to get to sleep at night.
Oh yes. And then I'd have to take the Siamese because, you know, that's like listening to Pavarotti. You know, it's the most amazing sound. And, you know, the snow leopards with those amazing tails. There wouldn't be any animals left in the zoo to... So I'd have to stay.
It's too silly then. There's no animals left in the zoo to sell.
No. I think sometimes I could be sitting back drinking a glass of champagne on a beach somewhere, but hey, no, that's not me.
It's been great to speak with you, Sally. Thank you so much for sharing your story and that difficult story about Jamila as well. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much.
I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.